Welcome to the Think Data podcast, brought to you in partnership with Dataworks. If you want to stay up to date with the latest breakthroughs and trends in the world of data and artificial intelligence, and if you're curious about some of the strategies that companies and founders use to launch data and AI products, then you're in the right place. Our aim is to bring together a diverse lineup of fantastic guests, from the founders through to accomplished leaders and product owners at some of the most fascinating data and AI companies worldwide. They will each offer you their own unique insight into what it takes to launch and scale a great data business. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the episode. This is the Think Data podcast in partnership with Dataworks. And today I welcome Sasha Krichinic to the show. Sasha is a software and AI investor at Headline, who are an international venture capitalist firm. Sasha is really active in the field of artificial intelligence. In my opinion, he's probably one of the best placed individuals to offer his unique insight into what it takes to build and scale a great business. So thanks for coming on. And I, you know, as I alluded to, you've been at Headline just over a year. I was really interested to kind of hear a bit more about your backstory, really.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess growing up in Australia, studied law and corporate finance, kind of middle of the road degrees. And when I thought about, hey, what is it that I really want to do, and like to like satiate this kind of burning curiosity, I was always fascinated by venture capital. And then when the happenstance happened to come over to San Francisco, an Australian startup as an operator. And then I actually got the opportunity to get exposed to the ecosystem and the people. And so one part of it actually was amazing. And I was like, whoa, this is just as amazing as I'd imagined. But then there was also another part, which was like, okay, this is not what I'd imagined. And it felt like sort of like meeting your heroes a little bit. But I actually met Thomas Mountain Biking, one of the GP and one of the founders of Headline. And the more he described the team, the culture, and how they made decisions, the more it enticed me back to consider venture capital as a potential a career option. And at that time, I was actually thinking about starting my own company, but this ended up being one of those options. I was like, hey, I can kind of have my cake and eat it, speak to these fantastic founders, stay at the cutting edge of tech, and also help grow things. So that's kind of the broad, but essentially Headline itself, just the data-driven approach that Headline's refined over the 25 years that it's been running. It's such a mature approach to both how they work with founders, but also how they make investment decisions. And I also love everything. I mean, including how they find founders and the way that they reach out. And there is a global reach there, which means you get to speak to founders from all walks of life, which I love as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I know on a previous call, you talked about kind of that unique platform that Headline have. Can you kind of go into a bit more detail into how that works? Because it is really uniquely positioned and actually generally is using kind of data and, you know, very clever insights to kind of drive some of your decision making.
Yeah, sure. So I'd say the first thing that is worth mentioning here is Deep Dive. It's a tool that we've actually developed in-house to help us actually identify, does a company have product market fit? And it just feels like such a nebulous term. What does product market fit mean? But we've actually broken it down to a couple of core mechanics that we look for. And it's actually a tool that we use so much, and we found ourselves coming to the point eventually and saying, hey, we should probably open this up to the community, because this is something that they'd actually benefit from massively. So, you know, if anyone's wondering, hey, do we have product market fit? Have we reached it? You know, feel free to check out on the website. It's effectively like an investor's version of Mixed Panel on steroids, and it's free. So highly recommend that. On the sourcing side, the only thing I can really share publicly is that we use publicly available data to help make sure that we're reaching out to founders, to the right founders, but also at the right time. And that's something that I'm really, you know, that I really like, because I think it's just such a mature approach. Rather than kind of spraying and praying founders, you're actually reaching out to the right people at the right time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I know I touched on the kind of the intro that kind of you're embedded heavily in the kind of software and AI piece. I know kind of artificial intelligence for you is also a, you know, hugely kind of, you know, hugely passionate about that space. And what I'd be interesting to touch on, because,
you know, we are going through a period where there's been 12, 18 months of kind of market correction, whilst has also been coincided with this real boom in kind of Gen AI or machine learning based products and companies flooding onto the market. But when you and Headline are looking at these companies and founders, you know, without obviously giving too much away, but what are you typically looking for? What high level attributes or kind of characteristics are you looking for?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a part of that that is very easy to answer, which is, you know, the product market fit component. And so let's say that's something like, you know, we're looking for 9 to 12 months of traction, and we're looking for things like asymptotic retention, strong month-on-month growth over that period, those sorts of things, good unit economics, good capital efficiency, all of the things that mean a business can get to a $1 billion outcome. The part of that question that's a little bit more nuanced and harder to answer right now is like, I don't know if... it's actually very tricky to evaluate moats right now. And it's very hard to understand, you know, because the rate of innovation is so high and the landscape changes, you know, every 6 to 12 months. It's actually kind of hard to look forward and kind of say, hey, is this something that's going to exist even, you know, 12 months from now? So that component of it has gotten tricky, and it's actually a really exciting time to be in venture for that reason, I think, because it means that you do have to go out, gather the data, understand, stay curious. And I think it's those sorts of players that benefit the most from this kind of upheaval and chaos, which is good.
Yeah, you touched an interesting point there, because it is, you know, from a fundraising market, it's still very challenging. But equally from companies trying to raise capital, they're needing to do far more to obviously convince the likes of Headline and other VCs that they're the right company to receive investment on. And actually with artificial intelligence moving at such a rate, how, you know, is it almost like you touched on kind of use case or product market fit? Are you really looking at kind of the space that, or the problem it's trying to solve ultimately, and seeing if that has legs? Because you're right, the technology is changing every single day, but in terms of the problem it's solving, that has probably got a longer kind of runway.
Yeah, and I think when we are going through some of the paradigm shifts that we are right now, we might actually get to a point where, I'll give you an example. If let's say we get to automation being so capable that, you know, let's say customer service, you know, style jobs, you know, become more automated, it might be that you don't need as many HR tools to kind of assist in the hiring and the managing and the payroll and all of those aspects as well. So it's actually interesting. Some problems, you kind of have to trace them back to their source and be like, wait, does this problem exist because of some other dependencies that might be removed? And then you can kind of remove all of that. So it is actually interesting. But I think it is the intersection between, if you draw a Venn diagram, I think it's like the intersection between the problem space, the solution space, and then the go-to-market. And I think founders and people in the space, like, I highly encourage them to think about how the paradigm change is happening across all three components there. And I think that's a good framework to kind of navigate, you know, the next 12, and thinking actually on like a greater than 2 to 3 year horizon here, because if you do see the paradigm shifts becoming so frequent and so often, you can actually just zoom out and say, wait, this is the status quo. What's the best operating model to have during this period? And, you know, a good example, I think, here is like the battle between, you know, do we fine tune these incrementally, these smaller models, or do we lean on these larger generalist agents? And I don't know that answer is going to be clear in the next 2 to 3 years, because there's going to be paradigm shifts on both of them. And that's an example of somewhere where founders can just factor that in as part of their product market fit unknown, and actually build towards a landscape that's like abstracts above that in a way.
Yeah, you touched on a really interesting point there about where everyone's so hell-bent on focusing on people displacement. But actually what you touched on there, which is the first time I've heard it, is actually the product displacement as a result of potential change in a trend. And I think the big thing you talk about, contact center, automation, AI agents, that's ripe for disruption. But equally, all the SaaS products and associated platforms that support call rooms or contact centers, then they also need to innovate. So it's really interesting. And how, you know, if you look at high level, when you're getting the analysts coming to you, they're talking about the market conditions and giving you advice on where to focus those kind of those calls on, what are they saying about the current state of the market? You know, how bullish are they in terms of how investable companies are now versus maybe waiting a little bit? Because we are in this weird kind of period of flux, I believe.
Yeah, there is a weird limbo, I think, and you're right. I think the way to navigate this and the proxy that I use, which actually isn't a proxy, I think this is probably as close as you can get to the source of truth with publicly available information, is reading research papers. Archive, it absolutely warms my heart to see just how strong that community is and how much they share the information. And, you know, scanning and reading maybe the top 4 or 5 papers per month, I think will put a lot of investors, operators, founders in a much better position to navigate the landscape and see, hey, this is what's going to come, you know, X months down the line. And it's actually been really interesting watching that space and seeing how that research is commercialized. In, you know, it used to take years or a year and a half or so, and it's now come down to like 5-6 months where you see a paper published and you see the kind of the startups show up on your radar a couple months later, which is really interesting. And I think if I zoom out on that trend there and just how that's being, how quickly that innovation is evolving, is I think there's almost like this Doppler effect. If you picture a stone skipping over water, where each time it makes contact is like these ripple effects of the business implications that kind of go out. But the tricky thing here is you have to imagine that each time this stone touches the water, is actually accelerating instead of slowing down. And I think that's probably the best way of describing a lot of the signals that I'm seeing here, is that there's a core group of, let's say, 3,000 to 5,000 innovators that are actually pushing the frontier really, really quickly. And then there's a lot of these like waves that are and ripples that are coming out beyond that. So that's, I think, the kind of mental model to adopt potentially right now to help people navigate. And I think the open source community is a good measure then for the ripples and how that's being commercialized and you know what you can expect to be available in a broader ecosystem outside the closed models. So yeah, I think that's like probably the best way of tracking what's happening and having the exact same information that I have, you know. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's a fair point. I think you were touching about the kind of closed models versus obviously the open source, and you've only got to look at the impact we see in the market when OpenAI announce, you know, a change or a new product release, and then a lot of these kind of founders who think they've fallen across the kind of next $1 billion business suddenly realize actually, you know, that's going to be solved elsewhere. So do you think there's going to be there's going to be probably more of a focus on people to really own their proprietary data and models themselves and say, actually, this is, you know, we can't rely so much on these other organizations that overnight can, you only got to look at GBTs when the store got released, and also all of a sudden these wraparound Gen AI companies are thinking, oh no, you know, we're actually not as valuable as we think we are.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of the models are not enterprise ready, and there's a lot of concerns around data privacy and data ownership and those sorts of things. I don't know that people have figured it out. You know, you can see that people are struggling even, you know, potentially sharing their data with OpenAI. It's a question I get quite often, is like, hey, you know, is it safe? Is it, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm not in a position to give you legal advice. Like, I don't know, speak to your lawyer. So it is a tricky one for people to actually buy. And I think that's actually probably one of the things that's slowing down some of this amazing tech in terms of how it's propagating. It's just people just don't even know how to navigate some of the real world consequences of it. So
I'd agree. I also think the sheer cost, we should hopefully see that coming down as well, but you're right, there does feel that being that companies are innovating, but there's some certainly feels this period of flux at the moment, whilst it could be in sync with the market, let's be honest, but equally there's, you know, the cost of actually building this in-house it is expensive, and actually it is easier to kind of you know, go open source. And I'm interested to touch on, going back to original point about what you and Headline look at in companies, and you gave a really good answer. And actually, you know, retrospectively, when you look at startups that may have failed or fallen short on maybe what you're expecting or what you've just seen them in other markets, what are some of the major pitfalls you're seeing in startups right now?
I'd say it's a nuanced answer, but specifically looking at like the audience for this, like the one thing that I want to impart on anyone in the AI space is a lot of the founders that are fantastic at state of the art models, creating, you know, innovating, all those sorts of things, are struggling with just some of the B2B kind of go-to-market basics. Mm. And it's not that surprising. Like consumer-focused companies, like so much of their strategy depends on distribution and those sorts of things. And in this space, I think, you know, the career tracks and the evolutionary trees of a lot of these professionals has been a very different pathway. So it got to the point where I'd say, when I would see, I mean, eventually you see a lot of companies and a lot of them are in a struggling phase and they're trying to show that the upside, which is, you know, the whole part of the game. But I'd say half of the time I would end up speaking to the founder and saying, hey, let's just quickly run through, like, let's use the rest of this time to run through and do some like go to market 101. And I'll teach you some of the basics, like how to speak to customers, how to identify your ICP, how to get that Venn diagram of the solution, the problem, and the go to market. And because a lot of these deep tech founders are great at coming up with the solution part, but then they miss the other two. And it's really important. This only really works. You can only really commercialize it if you get all three. So I think the advice to founders would be just make sure you see that there are two products. The first product is the one that's actually solving the problem. The second product is to sell the first product, which is kind of counterintuitive. But I think that's an explanation I found seems to resonate. It's like the second product, go off, do the interviews, do the discovery, build the product that distributes your first product and keep those experiments running, because that's going to be your feedback loop and actually getting good quality data in terms of what's working, what's not working, how are people using your product, where should you be, when they go to look for these solutions, where do they go to look for them? All those sorts of things are really, really important. And the I think good analogy here is, I mean, if you look at how IBM Watson, you look back all those years, how much it promised and how small the reach ended up being compared to a ChatGPT. And, you know, you could argue that AI has been progressing this whole time, but I think that B to C to B component that ChatGPT unlocked in terms of both having the training data and the go-to-market through the lead generation, that's a really beautiful example of you know, when this goes right, and you can kind of see some of the consequences when it does come together harmoniously.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it is interesting, as you touch on the technologists or innovators and highly intelligent scientists or you know, engineers. But many founders we speak to and see have never worked in a commercial environment. They've come out straight of a research lab. They've been incubated in one of the top universities, and then they've suddenly been given this capital and, you know, right, go and build a business. And it's a tricky predicament, isn't it? Because you're buying talent, you're buying an idea, but equally some of the best companies we've seen have got their founding team very clear. They've got the CMO, you've got the CRO, you've got the CTO, and they cover the three. So is that kind of what you're saying? You're kind of saying, well, actually make sure you're not forgetting about point product two here, because without product two, product one is just not going to fly.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, obviously looking, we are in a tougher market. Conditions are a bit all over the place at the moment. But when someone's coming to you and obviously they're looking for investment, they're looking to ultimately scale, what kind of non-negotiables and advice do you offer those founders?
So I think there's almost like a company mechanic component. Mm-hmm. So in addition to those three that I mentioned before, of like the problem, solution, and go to market. The other one, I think there is like a company mechanic, which is what are the unit economics of your actual acquisition cycle and how long does it take for you to pay back that acquisition? Mm-hmm. Then there's also the capital adequacy and you know, capital efficiency of the business is like, hey, for every dollar of burn that you get, what does that come out to look like in terms of gross profit? And, you know, there's multiples that you can look at there. Like AI founders are right now probably seeing something like 20 to 50x multiples. So that they, if they can raise, they actually get some very favorable terms, and they get a lot of runway. This is me speaking broadly about the market, not making a recommendation about design or anything like that. But I think when you are in that sort of, let's say, predicament, actually, where you have to raise, or where you get a lot of money and there's a lot of obligation that actually ends up starting to look more like a burden, having that much money and how to deploy it. So the one thing that I would say, I mean, there's a lot of operational execution style considerations there, but the one thing I'd say is like really, really making sure that you have a viable and sustainable training and distribution motion in the one motion. And the reason I say this is because compute and the training costs here, you don't want that to be something that ends up being, hey, part of your COGS. You want that to be considered and for something that you can say, hey, like we've trained this model and now we've gotten to a point where we get a lot of really rich data, which kind of in a way pays for itself, and the training is more accessible to us. So again, leveraging that ChatGPT example, you know, to do a lot of the human feedback. OpenAI, I think I saw a headline saying something like they employed 1,000 people in lower cost economies to basically go through and label the data and choose basically the better of the two responses. So they had, I think at that time, 100 employees, but they had 1,000 people helping them with fine tuning. And if you think about that, that's an advantage that, you know, an OpenAI can get by raising a couple hundred million or $1 billion straight off the bat. But in terms of scalability for a lot of these other founders, you know, I think you have to kind of look at it and be like, how can we combine that training and that distribution engine in the one motion? And again, the ChatGPTs of the world, you know, you've got 100 million people using this product who are helping to refine their current product, but more than likely, they've got the capability to sub in a GPT-5 response here and there. Now, you know, and you don't know what model you're speaking to when you're speaking. Like they might say it's GPT-3, but they'll sub in a, you know, but they've got that ability to go in and basically rank, okay, what was the engagement? What was the retention rate? What was the, did they choose A or B out of this, out of the two examples that we gave them? And you think about just how powerful that is in terms of creating that flywheel of having the best model, but then also having the scalable training capability there. So I think that I think is potentially going to be the new operating model and the way to find how to create a scalable, you know, AI startup in that sort of business and consumer space at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating insight there. And it's, I think the way founders will need to think is going to change. You know, it's not good enough now just to say, I've got a great product. It's actually great because I've got a great idea. It's actually, well, how do we get this to market? You know, ultimately, how are we going to scale this? How are we going to fine tune it? How are we going to pay for it? Because exactly. And obviously, again, that B2C, the B model, and actually having this constant feedback loop from those customers and those, you know, that's getting that well dialed in. I'm guessing from your standpoint, it's evident, just speaking to you now, you know a lot about this space. And I talked right at the beginning, you're very active on LinkedIn. I think we picked up this conversation off a post you put out.
Yeah.
If you had your kind of crystal ball and you looked into 2024, I know we're kind of in the end of Q1. How are you feeling this year will shape up?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really interesting data hiding in plain sight here. And I think between reading the research papers, following some of the core that, like, let's say that there's 3,000 people, there's some people who post pretty heavily and share pretty openly, like the things that they're seeing and the movements that they're seeing. And if you apply a first principles perspective on this, I think you can start to piece together where the big opportunities are. And I'll share these on my own personal opinions, and you know, time will tell if there's any truth and accuracy to them. But I think the rate of development is actually going to increase from here. I think the amount, you look at the amount of people, the amount of capital, the amount of hardware, the amount of software, the amount of data sets available, it's like all going exponential. So I think when you start to look at just the enabling ecosystem that exists now, it's actually really interesting. And I think when you start to combine these very segregated capabilities and you start to combine them, what we're going to start to see is more and more commercial applications growing exponentially. So, you know, an example here might be, you know, just recently Sora from OpenAI came out, combined that with 11 labs, and you get to the point where you could potentially have at-home desktop-style directors creating Netflix miniseries and those sorts of things. And that's something that if you'd asked someone, you know, 18 months ago, hey, would something like this be possible? They would be like, they would say, no, you're dreaming. That's not, yeah. But here we are 18 months later, and it's a complete paradigm shift, you know, and Hollywood is watching this space very closely. I think the next big one, if I combine, like, what's the one of those that, like, where you combine two capabilities, it's going to potentially be huge. I think it's going to be computer vision combined with reasoning. A lot of the big labs are working on this, and they actually openly talk about the fact that they're trying to crack reasoning. Computer vision, I think GPT-4V came out by API yesterday. You combine these two and you look at the number of workflows that can happen if a model can see your screen and if it can interact with your mouse and keyboard. I mean, that's actually a really, really powerful interface.
Yeah.
That's a universal API that can basically touch anything. So I wouldn't be surprised if we got to a point where something like that was unlocked in the next 12 months. And you can imagine all the workflows that you can do if you can move a mouse, a keyboard, and see the screen, right? So for that reason, I actually think the models will, both in perception and in capability, tend to go more generalist. And I think the battle between fine-tuning and specializing models versus creating generalist foundational models, I think the generalist agents will be the ultimate winners, I think.
Yep.
I think the B2C to B is like the new PLG, and incorporating that training and distribution in the same motion, I think that's going to be continue to happen. I think the real frontier here is, like, in terms of then getting to AGI, is going to be depending on, like, planning and the ability for these models to both reason, set milestones, execute on those, and understand whether or not they are on track to hit the objective. So on that front, when I look at, like, the research papers on and the amount of attention on logic and reward systems, I think AGI is actually a lot closer than a lot of people think. So I can't say that it'll be here in 2024, but I think it is a lot closer, and we might start to see some glimmers of that in later this year, depending on how. I mean, actually, a lot of the companies are actually already hinting at, you know, be prepared for a lot better reasoning capability.
I was just taking it all in. It just seems there's so much, isn't there? And if you think of back 18 months, 2 years, the fact we're even having this conversation and how much and how quickly things are changing over the next kind of 6, 8, 12 months, it's exciting, but I appreciate it. For some people, it can be quite scary.
Yeah, I think it is. But ultimately, if I look into my crystal ball and I look at, like, hey, what are the implications of a lot of this stuff, like the second and third order implications, I actually think it's going to be massively positive for society. Mm. I don't want to say the lower 50th percentile of income earners are actually going to benefit from this the most. Because imagine you've got, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever, 10 years from now, you've got a model in your pocket that's your accountant, your lawyer, your therapist, and, you know, you can make an informed decision. That information asymmetry could, you know, change very, very drastically, and the quality of life and quality of health of people is going to improve. And, you know, if we're spending less time in offices doing repetitive, you know, work and those sorts of things, it's not necessarily a bad thing. So
no, I can agree more. Good point to kind of end. And I think it's been really good to talk to you, Sash, and I will make sure everyone listening, either on the YouTube or on the audio version, we tag your LinkedIn profile and your name, because you do push out some really awesome content. And for anyone listening, give Sasha a follow. Puts a lot of content out, really relative market insight, really knowledgeable, as you can all tell. So no, thanks, Sasha. It's been my pleasure to have you on, and I feel we could talk for hours, but I won't. But thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thanks. Bye-bye.